So hi everybody, my name is Ulay Shamiloglu and I'm a recovering proposal writer.
Hello Ulay.
it's 12 step system here, 10 step system. So on behalf of the Central Asian Studies program and the Central Asian Lecture Series and Ted Gerber, the CRECA director who happens to be in Boston, I'd like to welcome all of you to today's CRECA event. Before I forget, the most important announcement is please remember next week is spring break and there is no CRECA event. So use the time wisely to do something else and to get some rest. So I'm really delighted to welcome back to Madison Cynthia Werner, who's an old friend. We have known each other many years. And is it okay to say that it was just like almost two decades ago that you were here one summer studying Kazakh with Kengisbay Musayev when we were doing summer courses in Central Asian languages in the early 90s. So Cynthia did her undergraduate work at Texas Christian University, and then she did her master's in the Department of Anthropology at Indiana University, and she completed her PhD at Indiana University in the Department of Anthropology, working with our dear friend Nazif Shahrani, and her dissertation was Household Networks, Ritual Exchange, and Economic Change in Rural Kazakhstan, and she's finishing up now a book on Household Networks, Ritual Exchange, and Economic Change in Rural Kazakhstan. And she also has other projects on, for example, fallout in Kazakhstan, the politics of risk after decades of nuclear testing. So if anybody's interested in a list of her publications, we have a couple of copies. I'm not functional enough to go too much more beyond that right now, so I'm lucky I can stand on my own two feet. But so we've been trying to get Cynthia up here for a while, and it's always a pleasure to see her, and I'm very delighted that she could be addressing today the topic of bride abduction in Central Asia, marking a shift towards patriarchy through local discourses of shame and tradition. So please join me in welcoming.
Okay, thanks for that introduction, Ulay. It's always great to be back in Madison. It has been almost 20 years since I was here studying Kazakh, and that was my first time ever studying a Turkic language. After that, I studied Uzbek at Indiana University and Kazakh there as well. So today my paper is about bride abduction, and I am going to read most of the paper. My first encounter with bride abduction took place in 1994 while I was conducting fieldwork in a rural town in southern Kazakhstan. I was living with a Kazakh family when the neighbor's 18-year-old daughter, Raisa, was abducted by a stranger who lived in a nearby village and wanted to marry her. A few months later, my host family's 19-year-old daughter, Aygul, was abducted by her college boyfriend. Although the Soviet Union established laws banning forced marriages in the 1920s, these two experiences revealed that bride abductions were a reality in the 1990s, and that they varied greatly from one case to the next. While Larissa was surprised and upset by the abduction, Aygul conspired in her own kidnapping in order to avoid a marriage that her parents preferred. In the months and years that followed, I heard many more accounts of bride abduction. And in the fall of 2000, I conducted extensive interviews on this topic. I found that Raisa's case was an extreme but isolated one. Although most women are kidnapped by men that they know, and many are kidnapped with their full consent, other women like Raisa are kidnapped by strangers without their consent. My research on bride abduction shows that Kazakhs in southern Kazakhstan believe that the frequency of non-consensual bride abduction has been increasing since the late 1980s. Similarly, the frequency of bride abduction has been increasing in neighboring Kyrgyzstan, where the practice seems to be even more widespread. The practice of bride abduction is very complicated. There's a lot of variation in the motives behind kidnapping and the degree to which the woman and her family consent to the kidnapping. In addition, the practice has transformed in significant ways during the Soviet and during the post-Soviet years. I plan to do four things in this paper. Starting with the present, I want to expand on the two cases of kidnapping that I mentioned in order to illustrate what happens during an abduction and to describe the typical sequence of events during bride abduction. Here I'll also emphasize the amount of variation that can be found from one case to another, especially regarding the level of consent and the variety of motives. Second, I want to place these cases of kidnapping within a historical context. After 70 years of Soviet rule, the practice of kidnapping, let alone the existence of non-consensual kidnapping, is quite fascinating. From its inception, the Soviet state tried to transform the patriarchal nature of Central Asian society by providing women with new opportunities for education and employment, and by banning several marriage practices that limited a woman's freedom of choice. Rather than disappearing, the practice of bride kidnapping transformed in a way that reflected women's new position in society. The practice has continued to transform in the post-Soviet context in a way that reflects the withdrawal of the state from gender-sensitive social issues. And third, I'll return to the present and discuss one of two issues that's contested by local community members, and that's the issue of what a woman should do after she's been abducted against her will. Combining anthropological theories on honor and shame with feminist understandings of gender-based violence, I argue that cultural values related to honor and shame have been mobilized in a way that justifies the popular view that a woman should stay after being abducted, and that these views help men assert further control over female mobility and female sexuality in the post-Soviet period. Borrowing Foucault's notion of resistance, however, I demonstrate in a variety of ways Kazakh women are resisting the power that comes from shame. Finally, I'll look at how Kazakh and Kyrgyz people talk about how bride abduction fits into their national traditions. A significant difference exists between attitudes in Kazakhstan, where non-consensual bride abduction is not perceived to have strong ties to the past, and views in Kyrgyzstan, where non-consensual bride abduction is defended by some as a national tradition with long historical roots. In Kyrgyzstan, international and local activists have challenged the historical legitimacy of this practice, arguing that its current manifestation is a violation of human rights. This localized debate relates to broader anthropological concerns about the conflict between cultural relativism and human rights issues, and the relationship between narratives of the past and politics of the present. Owing to the belief in the historical legitimacy of bride abduction, combined with values related to honor and shame, I argue that male control over female mobility and female sexuality has become more pronounced in Kyrgyzstan, as reflected by higher rates of non-consensual abduction. Now, turning back to these first two cases, I want to give a few more details. The first one, I've given the pseudonym Laura to this woman who lived across the street. She was 18 years old. She lived in a family with seven other siblings. She was one of seven daughters in the family. The youngest child was a boy. She was the third daughter. And one night, her parents were out at a dinner party, and she is at home babysitting her younger siblings. And some men came into the compound where she lived and physically abducted her, put her into a car, and started driving to one of the boys' house. There were four boys in the car. I first learned of the story when her parents came home from the dinner party and realized that their daughter was missing. They came over to their neighbor's house, knocked on the door, sat down and had tea with us. Everyone in the house woke up and we were drinking tea, and they were recounting the story. They didn't know where she was at the time. They were asking if they could borrow a car, and they had suspected that she'd been kidnapped. According to Kazakh custom, after someone's been kidnapped, eventually the boy's family will send word to the bride's family that this had not yet happened. They were looking for their daughter, and they were very worried, and they did suspect that she'd been kidnapped. Meanwhile, Laura's driving with these boys to this house, and she's looking in the car to see if she recognizes any of them. She recognizes one of the boys, someone that she'd gone to school with, but didn't know that well. And she ends up driving to another boy's house. So the person who kidnapped her was a complete stranger, a friend of this boy that she knew. And she was not a stranger to him. He had seen her one day in the bazaar, thought that she was very attractive, thought that she might be a suitable wife. He did some research through his friends, found out where she lived, found out that she came from a good family, and his friends helped him plan this abduction. His family was also involved. When they arrived at the house, they had already prepared food. They invited relatives over. They were already celebrating the marriage of their son to this woman. So eventually the groom's family sent word back to the bride's family the next day, and something called the apology delegation arrived, as several members of the groom's family arrived at her family's house, both to offer some money in the form of bride wealth and a verbal apology for what happened to her. Then members of her family went over to the groom's family to check on her condition and to start the reconciliation between the two different families. The family did learn in this process, this delegation, they learned that she didn't know this boy. She was upset that the boy who kidnapped her was almost 10 years older than her. The family did not have any significant source of income. The boy lived with his elderly parents, and none of them were employed at that time. So she wasn't too happy about this. But her parents thought that she should stay because it is shameful for the girl to return home. Fortunately, the story does have a happy ending in that she did fall in love with her husband eventually. They did have several children the next time I saw her several years down the road. The second case is the daughter of the family that I was living with across the street. She was 19 years old. She had a boyfriend. They were both attending college in the nearby city of Turkestan. They had been dating for a couple of months in complete secrecy. Her family finally found out about this, and they were upset. They had their own idea of who she should marry, one of her father's college roommate's children or son. And they also knew her boyfriend's family. They didn't know them personally, but they'd heard about this family. The father was somebody who was known to drink a lot, and they just thought that it'd be a better match for her to marry their friend's son rather than this boy that she was dating and that she was in love with. So they told her that she should stop dating him, and she agreed and cried and just thought this was awful, but she continued to date him in secret. Then one night she heard her parents talking about this other boy, and she got very nervous, and she starts talking to her boyfriend, and they decide that maybe he should kidnap her as a way to get out of this other potential marriage that might be happening sooner than she would have liked. They did not plan a specific time or date. Her boyfriend surprised her one day. She happened to be doing an internship in the nearby city of Shymkent. And one day he came to take her out to lunch, and instead of taking her back to work, he drove her back to the village and went to his family's house. She was not opposed to this. She had agreed in advance to the idea of marriage, just the day that it happened was a surprise. And meanwhile, her own aunt and uncle, where she was staying at the time while doing the internship, noticed that she didn't come home at the right time. They call her parents, who were very anxious and wondering, what had happened to her. They suspected right away that this relationship that she previously had was still ongoing, so they went to the boy's family in an effort to take her home. When they got to the house, they asked to see their daughter, and sure enough, there she was, and this family was also celebrating this new marriage. And she came out, and at that time, she told her parents that this is where she wants to stay, and that, like her mother, she wanted to marry someone of her own choice. So those are two versions that kind of show the variation in the level of consent, among other things. I wanted to show this slide just to show that there is a typical sequence of events. Even though there's a lot of variety from one case to another, there is a lot of similarities from one case to the next. The first thing is that the girl or the bride is abducted. Often in contemporary times, this happens by car. The woman is often deceived into getting a ride home, and instead of going home, the boys will take her to the groom's house. Sometimes physical force is used, but more often deception is used. The next two things, the scarf and the letter, apply to when she arrives at the groom's house. There's moments where she can resist the marriage or show her acceptance of the marriage. When she first arrives at the house, the groom's female relatives will come out and offer her a kerchief. And this is a symbol of a married woman, and they will offer this and kind of try to force her to put it on her head. Even if the bride is accepting this marriage, she often resists the kerchief at first and eventually puts it on. If a girl is opposed to the marriage, she'll often resist much longer. She does not want to wear the scarf kerchief, and this is a sign of resistance. Similarly, the bride is asked to write a letter to her family saying that she came of her own will and this is her own decision to marry this person. And if she agrees to the marriage, she tends to write this faster. If she's not agreeing to the marriage, she will resist writing the letter. And I've heard of one case where the girl just kept writing, I did not come here of my own will. I don't want to be here. I want to go home. And the family kept dictating, no, you need to write this, and you need to write this now. Usually after she's written the letter, and sometimes after she's taken the scarf, the groom's family will send the apology delegation to the bride's family, and then this is followed by relatives from the bride's family arriving at the groom's family, and the beginning of gift exchange and the reconciliation between the two sets of families. And then after that, there's the Beth Ashar ceremony, literally the face opening ceremony, where the bride is introduced to the groom's family officially as the bride. And then there can be a religious nikah ceremony as well. The various cases that I've mentioned demonstrate the level of consent in bride kidnapping can vary quite a bit. Young men cite different and multiple motives for kidnapping their wives. When asked to describe the possible origins of bride kidnapping, many Kazakhs suggest that the practice developed as an option for a man when the parents of a desired woman objected to a marriage. This motive is depicted by the Kazakh proverb, if they give, take from the hand, if they don't give, take from the road. Berse kolonan, bermese jolonan. Surprisingly, although this proverb does apply to the first case I mentioned, very few of the people I interviewed cited this as a reason that they had kidnapped their wives. Instead, one of the most commonly cited explanations is an economic one. The cost of an arranged marriage are much higher than the cost for a marriage by abduction. In particular, the bride wealth and dowry are expected to be higher, and there's an additional expense of a girl leaving home feast. In addition to saving money, many men cite the need to save time. With an arranged marriage, not only do the in-laws have to meet and agree to the marriage, but both sides are expected to host an in-law feast, and both sides are expected to host an even larger wedding feast. Because of these costs, the wedding may be delayed for a long time. Sometimes the groom and his family do not want to wait a long time to complete the marriage. One reason that's often cited is that another young man might kidnap the woman, especially if she's attractive and desirable, so they want to kidnap her before she's kidnapped by somebody else. In other situations, the groom's family might find themselves in a situation where they have an immediate need for an extra hand to help with the housework. And finally, in a different situation, a boy might kidnap a woman that he's already impregnated. When it comes to kidnap marriages that involve lower levels of consent, the motive for kidnapping is often based on a belief that the woman might otherwise refuse the marriage. When this is the primary motive, the groom is taking advantage of the fact that once kidnapped, the woman will probably stay. In some cases, the man is simply afraid to ask the woman if she's interested in marrying him, or he perceives that the woman is not interested in him. In other cases, the subject has come up and the woman has specifically said that she's not interested, or she has said that she's not ready to get married because she'd first like to finish her education. In order to understand bride abduction in the present, I think it's important to consider what women's lives were like in the past and how women's lives were changed under Soviet rule. Although the historical and ethnographic record is incomplete and biased by ethnocentric source material and Soviet interpretations, accounts of pre-Soviet society offer a glimpse into pre-Soviet gender structures. According to all available sources, unmarried Central Asian women did not have much say about their life or their marriage choices. The Kazakh proverb, a girl's path is narrow, Kuzdin Jola Zhnishkia, aptly expresses the social constraints on a young Kazakh woman's life. Most Kazakh marriages were arranged by family members, and the bride and groom were still young children. After the groom's family members discussed a potential match, the groom's father would send an agent to the bride's father. If the match was successful, the groom's father would then send a delegation of matchmakers, or pudawar, who would negotiate the terms of the bride wealth and the plans for the wedding. Among wealthy nomads, boys married between the age of 12 and 15, while girls married before the age of puberty. For wealthy families, there was not much of a delay between engagement and wedding. Since poor families often had to pay the bride wealth in installments, the wedding for a son might be postponed until the age of 30 or even later. The bride and groom often did not meet more than once or twice before their wedding night. Marriages were exogamous in that the bride and groom could not be related within seven generations on the male side of the family. The groom's family paid bride wealth in the form of cattle to the bride's relatives, and the bride's family provided a dowry that included a yurt, household goods, clothing, and jewelry. These exchanges strengthen relationships among specific groups of in-laws while simultaneously establishing ties between different tribal lineages. Even the term for an arranged marriage, kudatusu, which literally could be translated as to make an in-law, emphasizes the establishment of affinal ties rather than the joining of a couple. The Kazakhs followed a patrilocal residence pattern, with the exception of the youngest son, who ideally stayed in the parents' yurt. The bride and groom received their own yurt or felt tent upon marriage, which was then erected within the groom's father's camp. The Kazakh verb for marry varies by gender. Men form a household, while women go out into life. This expression is quite fitting in that women, not men, were the ones to leave their natal home upon marriage to go live with another tribal lineage. And for women, marriage was more of a transformative event, and once married, young brides were expected to provide in-laws with household services and to have children. Although arranged marriages were the norm, there were a few exceptions in the pre-Soviet period. For example, older men sometimes made their own matches. This is especially true in the case of wealthy men taking on a second or third wife. Men might also take a second wife if there was a problem with the fertility of his first wife, or with his first wife. These marriages, however, still involved the rituals of matchmaking. Bride abductions were another exceptional form of marriage in the pre-Soviet period. Grooms would abduct brides in situations where the bride's father refused a marriage, disliked the groom's family, demanded an excessively high bride wealth, and/or violated the matchmaking agreement. There were also situations where a groom wanted to marry a particular girl, but she was already betrothed to another man. At least one source hints that some of these abducted brides might have played a role in planning their own abductions. Among the nearby Kyrgyz, the historical records suggest that non-consensual bride abductions were infrequent and were punished by customary law. After nearly two centuries of increasing Russian influence, the territory of present-day Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan was incorporated into the Soviet Union in the early 1920s. Within just a few years, the Russian-dominated Bolshevik leaders began a campaign against Central Asian traditional customs. Without much industrial development, the early Bolshevik leaders were unable to champion the cause of the working class in Central Asia. As Gregory Massel puts it, women served as a surrogate proletariat for these radical revolutionaries who vilified all manifestations of patriarchy, tribalism, and Islam in Central Asia. Beginning in the early 1920s, the Bolsheviks passed laws that banned various crimes of custom. Many of these crimes were practices that related to marriage, such as the payment of bride wealth, polygamy, child betrothals, leveret, and bride abductions. The new state also set the minimum legal age for marriage at 16, initiated a campaign against women's veiling practices, and created new conditions to increase gender equity in education and employment. State efforts to emancipate women initially encountered local resistance and eventually lost some of the zealousness of the early Bolshevik leaders. Especially in the years of early Soviet rule, there was often a significant gap between Soviet policy and actual practice, such that Central Asian families managed to circumvent Soviet laws that challenged customary marriage practices. For example, men continued to marry multiple women, but only registered one as their official wife. In addition, bride wealth payments were made in cash more often than in livestock in order to conceal the transfer. And regarding bride abduction, Gregory Massel describes how this was ignored in the early Soviet years under the following circumstances. A, if the abductor proved his honorable intentions by actually marrying the girl. B, if the abducted and violated girl refused out of shame or lack of viable marital alternatives to lodge a complaint in court. And C, if the girl forced into marriage by her parents and kinsmen refused out of loyalty to kinfolk and custom to testify against them. Despite these discrepancies between policy and practice, there's little doubt that women's lives in Central Asia were transformed during Soviet rule. Advances in education and employment have parallels elsewhere during the 20th century, yet they're still remarkable. In the early 1920s, similar to most Kazakh men, the vast majority of Kazakh women were illiterate and uneducated. By the eve of the revolution, many Kazakh families were still relying on nomadic pastoralism to meet most of their needs. Women did not work outside of the home, though some may have earned income by selling homemade products. By the time the Soviet Union dissolved in 1991, 96% of Kazakh women were literate, 52% of university students in Kazakhstan were female, and approximately 90% of women between the ages of 30 and 50 were employed. The Soviet state did also eventually succeed in widening the path of girls in terms of marriage. As part of my research, I interviewed people about how they got married. By the 1960s and 1970s, the vast majority of people were marrying somebody of their own choice, and many described their marriage as a consensual kidnapping. In 1991, the Kazakh Republic of the Soviet Union became an independent nation state. The newly independent Republic of Kazakhstan is a multi-ethnic state with over 15 million people. Just as the Soviet period affected women's lives, so the post-Soviet transition is clearly having its impact on women's lives. By the end of the Soviet period, Soviet women were accustomed to a state that provided a number of economic and social benefits for women: free education, guaranteed employment, generous maternity leaves, free daycare, and monthly supplements for women and children. Post-Soviet women are coping with the realities of an economy where the state has terminated its social contract with women and transferred many of the costs of social reproduction to the household level. In addition, several studies find that post-socialist states have nationalist agendas that promote the re-traditionalization of society. Kazakh nationalism gained momentum in the late Soviet years. Gorbachev's glasnost period permitted a re-examination of Soviet policies towards the Kazakhs. Although the post-Soviet Kazakhstan government remains secular and wary of Islamic fundamentalism, there's a growing acceptance of Islam as an important element of Kazakh national identity. Gender relations in Central Asia are being redefined as Islamic values are reinstated as the guiding ethic for society. National histories and national traditions are rewritten and revived, and patriarchal authority, symbolized by the male head of the state, is reasserted. Throughout Central Asia, contemporary discourses on gender are also shaped by the infiltration of outside Western fashions and lifestyles that are more sexually explicit. Now that the rigid borders separating East and West are gone, Kazakhs are now purchasing European fashions, watching South American television serials, and an increasing number of Kazakhs are also traveling abroad for trade, adventure, and study. These experiences in the global village contribute to the need to distinguish and maintain what's uniquely Kazakh. Marriages in the contemporary period reflect these public debates about gender roles and gender behavior. On the one hand, there's been a slight revival of arranged marriages as a traditional Kazakh practice, especially among the economic elite who can afford the associated expenses. These marriages sometimes start as a conversation between parents when the children are young. However, all of the arranged marriages that I learned about involve the consent of the bride and groom. On the other hand, there's been a significant increase in non-consensual bride abductions. Consensual abductions still occur regularly, but it's increasingly common for the groom to use some form of deception or force in order to kidnap a woman. And cases in which the bride did not know the groom before the abduction are increasing. The recent increase of non-consensual bride abduction has been documented in both Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, yet the issue has received more political attention in Kyrgyzstan, prompted by Western scholars, non-governmental organizations, and local government officials. International NGOs have started to press the government to take steps to address this issue. In 2006, for example, Human Rights Watch published a 140-page report on the problems of domestic violence and bride abduction in the Kyrgyz Republic. Among other things, the report recommends that the Kyrgyz government reinforce existing laws, compile statistics on unlawful abductions, establish a nationwide public awareness campaign, provide assistance for victims, and educate law enforcement officials. The UN Population Fund has also published a fact sheet on bride kidnapping in Kyrgyzstan and has included this issue in its gender equity programs. In response, the government has acknowledged the problem and held a public hearing on bride abduction in April 2007, organized by the Human Rights Commission of the government of Kyrgyzstan. In comparison, the issue of non-consensual bride abduction has gone relatively unnoticed in Kazakhstan. One Kazakhstani umbrella organization, Silk Road Women, acknowledges that bride abduction takes place in Kazakhstan, yet affiliated NGOs give much more visibility to the problem of human trafficking of Kazakhstani women to other countries. Further, international NGOs who describe this problem in Kyrgyzstan, including Human Rights Watch and UNFPA, have not made it a priority issue in Kazakhstan. And finally, international media coverage of this issue has been limited to Kyrgyzstan, This includes a production of a film about bride kidnapping that Fatima Sarbayeva, student here at University of Wisconsin, helped produce that was aired on PBS Frontline. And now I want to return to the issue of how people talk about a woman's decision to accept or reject a marriage after being abducted. And this is abducted against her will. Although most women feel pressured to accept the marriage, some women decide to return home. Many of the same people who told me that they believe it's wrong for a man to abduct a woman without her consent also believe that it's wrong for a woman to reject the marriage. These seemingly paradoxical views were held by both men and women. One of my research assistants told me several proverbs that suggest that it's a woman's fate to stay with her abductor and that it's bad luck for her to return home. Not only is it bad luck, but many Kazakhs believe that it's shameful for an abducted bride to return home. A woman who rejects the groom will be known as a girl who returned home. The significance of this stigma is best understood within the broader context of honor and shame, where a family's honor is linked to female modesty. Anthropological theories on honor and shame can help us understand why a woman would feel that she has little choice but to stay, and why parents who love their daughter dearly would also believe that it's her best option. Anthropologists working in the Middle East have long noted the link between male honor and female sexuality. The family's reputation can be damaged if a daughter, wife, or sister conducts herself inappropriately. Even unconfirmed rumors about inappropriate behavior can dishonor a family. The important thing is the public knowledge of the transgression. Although concepts of honor and shame resonate strongly throughout the Muslim world, there is great variation across time and space in what is considered to be appropriate female behavior and the extent to which men and women respond to behavior that's viewed to be inappropriate or shameful. Among Kurdish immigrants in Sweden, for example, a young woman who disgraces her family by dating a local Swede might be killed by her own male relatives. Anthropological theories about honor relate to bride abduction because the majority of societies that have bride abduction place a high value on virginity before marriage. A woman who has been kidnapped is not given the benefit of the doubt that she was an unwilling victim, and her status as a virgin is in jeopardy. According to the Kazakhs I interviewed, a woman's reputation is publicly questioned after she's been abducted. As Unni Khan argues, the reality of the situation matters much less than the fact that the possibility has entered the public conscious. This helps explain why girls who choose to return home try to keep this a secret and why they would be reluctant to pursue the case legally. In addition to having a dubious reputation, a girl who returns home is considered to be a bit stubborn and belligerent, two characteristics that are not highly desired by potential suitors or their parents. Although many Kazakhs might sympathize with the difficult situation faced by an abducted woman, many believe that she's better off accepting the marriage and provoking the shame that would befall her and her family if she returned home. When a woman is forcibly abducted, these cultural beliefs are invoked in persuasive performances to pressure the bride to accept the marriage. The social pressure comes from a variety of sources: the groom and his accomplices, the groom's relatives, and the bride's relatives. By accepting the marriage, the bride restores honor to her family while simultaneously preventing shame from falling upon the groom's family. Social pressure from the groom usually happens just after she's been abducted and before they go to the groom's house. They may include physical violence and threats of violence. For example, a young Kazakh woman described how her neighbor was abducted by a group of men who threatened to rape her if she shamed the family by declining the marriage. She was afraid and felt like she had no choice but to accept the marriage. After the groom and his accomplices bring the bride to the house, his female relatives play an important part in convincing the bride to stay. His mother, his aunts, and his sisters-in-law all remind her of the shame and unhappiness that will certainly befall her if she chooses to return home. After the groom's family informs the bride's family of her whereabouts, these same arguments are often reiterated by members of her own family. By pressuring the bride to accept the marriage, these older married women are helping to reproduce patriarchal institutions in a way that's reminiscent of Denise Candiotti's concept of the patriarchal bargain under conditions of classic patriarchy. Bride abduction is not simply the act of male dominance over women, as women also help to reinforce this dominance. At the same time, alternative voices do exist and offer emotional support to victims of non-consensual abductions. Some women and men do support their daughter's decision to reject an unwanted marriage. Further, I argue that brides abducted against their will are not passive agents. Barring Foucault's idea that existence of power engenders resistance, I argue that Kazakh women often enact their own performances of resistance in response to the power of shame that suggests that they should stay. These acts of resistance may or may not succeed. Abducted women need to act quickly if they want to avoid an undesired marriage. Once a woman realizes that she's been kidnapped, she may try to get out of the situation. Lizotte, a 20-year-old woman, told me how she talked her way out of a kidnapping situation. She was offered a ride by a friend, a male friend, home from a wedding. And while he was driving her home, she realized he was not taking her to her home. He was going in the direction of his own house, and she suspected that he was going to kidnap her. And she started talking to him and telling him, "I can't believe you're doing this. You're a modern, educated boy, and you shouldn't do this." And he actually listened to her and took her to her own home. Another woman, Medina, jumped out of a moving car in order to escape her abductor. Neither of these women were labeled as a girl who returned home because they were able to escape before they were brought into a public setting with lots of witnesses. After a bride crosses the threshold into the groom's house, she still has several opportunities to resist the marriage. Upon arrival at his house, a female member of the groom's house usually presents the bride with the headscarf and forcibly tries to put it on her head. Since married women traditionally wore the scarf over their hair, the bride's acceptance is a public sign that she is accepting the marriage. Brides who are abducted without their consent refuse to take or wear the scarf for as long as possible. And then there's also the issue of the letter. She's asked to write the letter stating that she came of her own free will. This is taken to her parents as evidence that she accepts the marriage. I talked to several brides who said that they were distraught for hours, screaming at anybody who approached them, refusing both the scarf and refusing to write the letter, throwing things around the room, pleading to be let go. One woman, Ayaram, told me that she was kidnapped when she was 20 years old. And when asked to write a letter, she kept writing, "I don't want to stay here. I didn't agree to this." The groom's aunts kept telling her that she had to write the note, and they kept bringing her fresh pieces of paper. Another woman told me how she tried to even break the windows in the room that she was taken to. In the case of Ayaram, she did eventually accept the marriage, and she did, after a few months, accept her husband's friendly gestures towards her, and she's now happy. Such acts of resistance often fail, but occasionally an abducted bride resists long enough to be rescued by her parents or even released by the groom's family. As one woman told me, a distraught bride should try to send an urgent message to her family via a friend who accompanied her to the groom's house. Often, when they're kidnapped with their friends, and they bring all of them to the house. And so she might have a friend with her in the house. She might also be able to get a message out through an ally within the groom's family. In one unusual case, an abducted woman managed to send a message to her boyfriend, who then came to her rescue. Instead of returning to her parents' house, she escaped from her abductor's home and was married to the man that she was in love with. Suggesting that this was not the proper way for a Kazakh woman to behave, my host father suggested that this young woman was probably influenced by all of the Mexican soap operas that were being shown in Kazakhstan at the time, and he even decided that the women in his household should not be allowed to watch them anymore. Cases like this demonstrate that some women are successfully able to resist unwanted marriages, though they may be publicly criticized for their actions. The final thing I want to talk about is whether non-consensual bride abduction is believed to be a practice with roots in the pre-Soviet past, or whether it's believed to be a new manifestation of a practice that has transformed and been transforming over decades. During my field work, when I asked Kazakhs to talk about the origins of bride abduction, most people seem to believe that arranged marriages were the dominant norm and that bride abductions were unusual in the pre-Soviet past. Several respondents even were concerned that non-consensual bride abduction was a shameful practice as it conflicted with their notion of what a modern state should look like, and they were concerned that I was studying it. Further, several people had detailed explanations for how marriage practices had changed in the 20th century. In reference to pre-Soviet traditions, one woman in her 20s explained that bride abductions in the past were limited to cases where the bride's parents objected to the marriage. In such cases, a woman might have used abduction as a way to resist patriarchal norms by conspiring with her intended groom. In another variation of pre-Soviet abductions, a woman told me that men from poor families used kidnapping to marry women from wealthier families. The Kazakhs I interviewed all believe that marriage practices changed significantly during the Soviet period, though they don't agree on how and when these changes took place. One middle-aged woman, for example, believed that bride abductions became more popular after collectivization in the 1930s because families could no longer afford to pay bride wealth. In contrast, two women who were elderly and got married in the 1940s mentioned how marriages at the time were still often arranged by parents without the daughter's input. During one interview, a middle-aged woman shared her theory on how bride abduction resolved a conflict between traditional Kazakh values and Soviet values. According to her, traditional Kazakh values meant that unmarried women were expected to listen to their parents and their elders when it came to marriage choices. Women who were abducted did not appear to be running away with a boyfriend, which would be shameful, and thus elders regarded them as appropriately modest. At the same time, she said, Soviet values encouraged women to select their own marriage partners, and these women were doing that in cases where the abduction was planned and staged. Numerous people told me that bride abductions during the Soviet years were less likely to involve deception or force, unlike many of the recent cases of bride abduction. For families with less income and fewer resources, bride abduction provided an alternative that reduced and delayed the cost of marriage without eliminating all of the expected celebrations. Bride abduction surged in popularity in the 70s, a time when average wedding expenses were increasing. Just as the motives for kidnapping vary greatly, so do the opinions towards non-consensual kidnappings. Many Kazakhs do make a strong moral distinction between consensual and non-consensual kidnappings. A woman in her 30s expressed strong sympathy for abducted brides who are not able to marry somebody they love. One middle-aged man told me that he was worried that my interest in bride abduction might bring greater awareness to this practice that he considered to be shameful for ethnic Kazakhs. Answers to my questions about bride abduction were certainly influenced by my position as a Western female anthropologist. Nevertheless, I find it interesting that so many people were willing to make strong moral judgments against kidnapping, whereas people in Kyrgyzstan have been more willing to defend the practice to Western scholars. The only people who spoke in favor of non-consensual bride abduction or in defense of it were young men who admitted that they participated in several such acts. These young men do not think it's important for women to consent to the marriage ahead of time, and they argued that abducted women will be happy after a few days. Although an anthropological perspective would question the very notion that traditions remain constant, local beliefs about the historical authenticity of bride abduction can have important political implications. As a Human Rights Watch report states, a consequence regarding bride kidnapping as a tradition is that it becomes part of the unwritten social charter and is deemed above criticism. In other words, activists who oppose non-consensual abduction are likely to have a stronger case if they can demonstrate that this is a new practice or a newly manifested version of an older practice. Regarding this issue, there appears to be a significant discrepancy between what people are saying in Kazakhstan, where bride abduction is fairly concentrated in the southern provinces, and what people are saying in Kyrgyzstan, where bride abduction is more geographically widespread and where the frequency of non-consensual abductions seems to be higher. In Kyrgyzstan, there seems to be a strong divide between a public notion that bride abduction is a traditional practice and the scholarly opinion that non-consensual abduction was rare in the past. In one survey conducted in northeastern Kyrgyzstan, 38% of respondents state that the primary motive behind a kidnapping case was that this was a good traditional way to get married. In a different survey, 40% of adults interviewed believe that non-consensual bride abduction was practiced in the early 20th century. According to the researchers, Kleinbeck, Amsler, and Salomjanova, these findings suggest that bride abduction is viewed as a culturally accepted practice that has been revived from pre-Soviet times. Another scholar, Laurie Handrahan, notes that bride abduction has become a primary act of defining cultural identity and manhood. Men are able to claim their Kyrgyz ethnicity by establishing dominance over women while abducting a Kyrgyz bride, while Kyrgyz women identify their loyalty to their ethnicity by accepting this act of violence. This is not to say that all Kyrgyz believe that non-consensual bride abduction is a national tradition. In addition to the 60% who disagreed in the survey, Feinbach and his collaborators have interviewed dozens of Kyrgyz scholars, the majority of whom disagree with the popularly held belief that this is a revival of a customary practice from the pre-Soviet past. Instead, these scholars believe that non-consensual abduction was very rare in the pre-Soviet period, and on many occasions, abduction did involve the consent of the bride against the wishes of her parents. Although violence against women can be found in all societies, certain patterns of violence, such as female genital mutilations and honor killings, have been defined as culturally determined practices. As transnational feminists and local NGOs take steps to change these practices, Conflicts often arise between activists who attack gender-based violence in defense of human rights and local community members who justify these practices in the name of culture. Feminist understandings of gender-based violence emphasize that violence serves as a mechanism for men to assert and maintain power over women. The threat of potential violence in any cultural setting where men regularly commit acts of violence against women has the effect of controlling or limiting women's behavior. In the case of bride abduction, shame is a key concept employed in discussions about whether an abducted woman should accept or reject a marriage. Even people who believe an abducted woman should not have to stay with her abductor or should not have been abducted believe that this act of resistance will bring shame to her and her family. Women who accept a marriage after being abducted avoid the shame that's inflicted on women who decide to reject the marriage. The concept of shame is not novel to Central Asia, but how shame is being used to delineate appropriate gender behavior in contemporary society represents a break with the Soviet past. During the Soviet period, the state promoted gender equality, and Central Asian women were encouraged to make their own decisions about whom they wanted to marry. In the post-Soviet period, the state has different priorities, such that the construction of a national identity has assumed more importance than the Soviet goal of achieving gender equality. The nation-building project in the present involves what Anagnos refers to as a re-narrativization of the past, and this process tends to romanticize ideal gender relations that may or may not have actually existed in the pre-Soviet period. Although neither men nor women had much control over marriage choices in the past, collective memories of the past tend to place more emphasis on the limited choices of women rather than the limited choices of men. In addition to the concept of shame, it's important to consider how popular conceptions of tradition mark a shift towards greater patriarchy. Throughout the world, acts of violence against women are often defended in the name of culture, with the end result that efforts to change these practices become framed as a struggle between culture and human rights. One of the many fascinating things about bride abduction is that the notion of whether this is a national tradition varies from one country to the next. In the case of Kyrgyzstan, popular efforts to reimagine a past where men routinely abducted women to become their wives are part of a larger political process in the present where the nation-state seeks to signal a sharp break with the Soviet past. Although views on the practice are contested, this form of violence against women has been associated with Kyrgyz identity. In Kazakhstan, there are also efforts to reimagine national traditions, yet the process does not involve a belief that bride abduction was a common marriage practice in the past. In both countries, I argue that post-Soviet discourses of shame and tradition are shifting power relations between men and women in ways that increase male control over female mobility and female sexuality. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cynthia. Do you want to take your own questions?
Yeah. Any questions? Yes.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the law and all this. You referenced at various points in the state, but that wasn't a big actor in your story. So you mentioned at the beginning that all of this stuff is against the law.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, this is a question that I always get. It is against the law. People can use the law in their favor, but most often they choose not to. And I'll give a few examples of why they may not choose to use it. First, I think there's the shame involved. If the woman chooses not to get married to the guy, she's trying to keep the fact that she was kidnapped in the first place a secret. So to take it to a legal case would just bring more publicity to the case. Secondly, there are individual cases where it would just make it very difficult. In one of my papers, I've written about how the daughter of a village police chief was kidnapped, and her family was furious. She was kidnapped against her will. They were very upset. The family, her parents went to the house to take her home. When they got there, the groom's uncle was there. He happened to be the mentor of her father, and they didn't know that he was gonna be there. He came in from Almaty to celebrate his grandnephew's wedding, and because he was there, it would have been too shameful for her parents to bring her home, even though that was their full intention, and they couldn't believe that someone would do this to the village police chief. So there's cases like that, and then on top of that, there's perceptions about corruption in the legal system and beliefs that it wouldn't necessarily get you anywhere anyway, that people would just be trying to outbribe each other.
Well, independent even of corruption, I'm just wondering, I work on law, so mm-hmm. the question of whether or not the police would be receptive
yes.
to that, is that a problem as well?
Yeah. Today I had lunch with Fatima Sarbaeva, and she was saying just that the police wouldn't take it seriously. So if they went, especially if the police were friends of the groom's family, they would probably just brush it aside. I went to the local court in the village where I was doing research and asked if I could look at the records of how many cases had gone to trial, and the local judge said, there is no bride kidnapping here. There are no cases to look at. And what do you do when somebody who has power to give you that information says that? So I didn't have access to those cases. Whether they exist or not is something that is definitely a great subject for future research, but I'm not sure there are many cases that go to
I'm
trial.
I'm just wondering, as an anthropologist, what is your position on what it takes for something
to change
the culture? Because if it's been on the books for decades, then it doesn't seem like it's really taken hold firmly within these certain parts of the culture.
Yeah, I do think things have constantly been changing. I think things were better during the late or mid to late Soviet years, and the non-consensual kidnappings have increased due to recent transitions, both economic as well as the nationalism and the politics. But at the same time, what it would take to change things, it would take a lot of things. It would take a police force that cared. It would take laws that were enforced. It would take social norms that were changed, and it may be possible to change these things. I think it would take local levels of activism. There are international actors who are interested in changing these things, as evidenced by the Human Rights Watch report and other reports, but a lot of their recommendations, whether they will be enacted, a lot of those things sounded very idealistic. But let's create a public awareness campaign, and that will change things. One of the actors is the film that Fatima was involved with. They have tried to show this around Kyrgyzstan, and it would be interesting to see whether the audience members who have watched this have changed their views towards kidnapping. But what's most problematic to me is in the Kazakhstan case, a lot of people will just say, oh, this is awful that this is happening. I feel bad for these girls, but she should stay because it's perceived to be wrong to go. And I don't know how to change that half of the equation.
So in the pre-Soviet period, you said that these situations are primarily consensual. And so when you're describing it, the abduction was consensual.
Yeah, when abduction happened, which was rare, it often was consensual.
Right.
Yes.
So to me, when you're describing it, it sounds a lot like what we would call
elopement. Yes.
Right. And so I was wondering if that's an adequate analogy, or if there's some ritualized drama, or some ritualized, like, even if I was going to abduct my girlfriend who wanted to do it, does she play resist?
Yeah, that's a good question. I should have mentioned that they use the same word for both types of, which is why in English we tend to refer to both kinds as bride kidnapping. It's kuzal pashu, to take the girl and run would be the most literal translation. So they use the same word, whether the girl consents to it or not. And then in terms of whether the girl pretends to resist, she usually does, because it would appear to be shameful for her to seem too eager to enter the marriage. To be a girl who runs away with her boyfriend is considered to be embarrassing. So they usually don't take the scarf right away. They will pretend like they don't want it. So in some cases they're pretending, in some cases they really don't want it. And that's what makes it really tricky to study the subject.
I just wanted to ask, first, what is the Kyrgyz government's reaction to all of this? I mean, you mentioned that they had an international conference, but I'm wondering if that was just something that they were doing to get the international community off the back. I mean, is it something that they more or less sort of ignore generally, or is it something that there's actually considered an effort at different, like, the Ombudsman or something like that? Do they take action? And the second sort of sub-question is there a lot of regional variation? So, like, in the south, like in Osh or something like that, is there a lot of abduction going on compared to, say, Bishkek or Nodin or something like that? And I mean, so how much of this is kind of that? And then also, like, you mentioned Turkestan as being the main region where Kazakhstan this occurs. Mm-hmm. So, I couldn't imagine that would happen in, like, Sinai or something like that. But, I mean, how much is there? What is regional dimension? And is there also regional, like, governors' reactions differ greatly?
Okay. Those are all both really complex questions. The first one is, what does the government think in Kyrgyzstan? And I'd say, when we say government, we often think of one monolith institute, but it's lots of different actors, lots of different institutions. So, yeah, maybe the Human Rights Commission of the government of Kazakhstan has taken this seriously, but do the police force take it seriously? Probably not. So I would say you'd have to look at different institutions, who's taking it seriously, who's addressing it. And for the most part, although the government of Kyrgyzstan has acknowledged it as a problem, I would hesitate to say that they've made it a huge priority, that this is the main thing that they're addressing. And then in terms of regionalism, that's also fairly complex. There's often perceptions of which region has higher levels of bride abduction. I'm more familiar with Kazakhstan, and in general people say, oh, that's something that happens in Shymkent. That's something that you see in the southern regions. But then I keep hearing cases of it happening in other areas, in Atrau and Semei. I've heard of cases. Recently I've been doing research in Mongolia, and it happens with Mongolian Kazakhs, some of whom have migrated to the Semei region, the Uzkhaman region. So in that sense it has happened there. Karaganda, I know a woman who's been doing research in Karaganda on kidnapping. So it's not just Shymkent, even though it's often perceived to be just Shymkent. It's also not just rural areas, even though it's often perceived to be rural, less educated people. A lot of the cases that I collected may be rural people, but they're people that have college education or attending college when it happens. And then in terms of Kyrgyzstan, I'd say that rates are also perceived to be higher in the south, in Osh, in other areas, Naran. More so than Bishkek, but I've also heard of cases in Bishkek. But again, I don't do research in Kyrgyzstan. I've just kind of incorporated the literature on Kyrgyzstan. I have not done interviews in Kyrgyzstan.
I mean, there's a certain distance from Bishkek from which, from all the villages, the boys drive to Bishkek to find a woman.
Uh-huh. So the boys don't come from Bishkek, but they go to Bishkek.
And they're often looking for a woman from the village in Bishkek, but they figure it would be easier to get there, and the village, all the girls have already been kidnapped out. So.
This is precious.
Okay. I have a question about what happens when the woman actually arrives at the house, and whether there was any physical violence that you've heard of that actually happens with the family of the groom, especially when they take her aside with just the women of the family. And then also, with the sort of play resistance versus fake resistance, are the in-laws sort of clued in to whether or not she is interested in being a part of the kidnapping and she's consented to the whole thing, or is it up to them to sort of figure out, well, she's really resisting as opposed to she's kind of fake resisting?
Yeah, those are also good questions and complicated. In terms of the resistance question of whether the in-laws have to determine it, I think some of them really don't know for sure. I think some of the men may not even care. I mean, they're kidnapping her, whether she truly exists. Eventually, some of them do decide they should let the girl go. That has happened in several cases. Before her family arrives, they do decide this girl really doesn't want to stay here. This is wrong to keep her. So in those cases, they are making those decisions, and they probably didn't know that much beforehand. They usually know that the groom is, their son is going to kidnap somebody beforehand. Whether they know all sorts of things about the kidnapping, it varies from one case to the next. So it's another way that there's so much variation in these cases. And sometimes in the consensual forms of kidnapping, it's consensual on multiple levels. That the bride's parents know about this, the bride knows about it, they were dating, and it's really just for economic reasons. So it's, again, lots of variation. And I forgot your first question.
It was about whether or not there's actually any
physical violence.
You mentioned that there are sometimes threats and sometimes even physical violence, but once they're actually at the house in the room, is there any sort of physical violence that you've heard of to get the bride to consent?
Not that I know of, other than just kind of pushing her into the back room. It doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but it's not something I've heard of. And the same thing, I mean, there is physical force getting her into the car, keeping her in the car. So there's violence at that level, but for like the female relatives to slap her around, it's not something I've heard of. It doesn't mean it's never happened.
Thanks. This has been a really interesting talk. And I was curious about your reconstruction of a historical narrative. Uh-huh. Naturally, the nature of your data is going to change. What's available to you now is available to you from Soviet and pre-Soviet times. And I'm wondering specifically whether you asked people about the role of narratives of shame under the Soviets, and whether, you know, the question of how laws act in people's lives, whether people talked about some laws being shameful to follow, or whether behavior in the Soviets also was shaped by that kind of informal talk.
Discourses of shame also being powerful during the Soviet period. I didn't look at it explicitly, but what I do remember from those interviews with people who got married in the, because I interviewed people that got married in different years, and there was this consistent pattern of those who got married in the 60s and 70s that there was just consent on so many levels that they even knew where and when the person was going to pick them up, which is very rare now. There's always some deception. And then there are the stories about how this would be a way to avoid the shame of running away by being kidnapped. You're kind of not being as, not perceived to be such an active person choosing the person that you wanted to marry. But it is a good question to follow up. And there's lots of questions that I think my research is just a start. There's so many different topics that need to be studied. Studies of masculinity, I think, would be really fascinating. Studies of how cell phone usage and increased cell phone usage has affected kidnapping. Because when I was doing research in 2000, cell phones were just starting to be used. And now I'm wondering if women could get text messages to their families faster to rescue them. And that's just a beginning of topics that need to be studied. So that would be added to the list. Yeah.
One of your slides mentioned the re-traditionalization of Kazakh society. You look into more to Islamic traditions in the, as part of Kazakh identity, or finds or rolling back Soviet policies that tried to reduce patriarchal qualities in the society. And I'm wondering, is it possible to say whether that has led to more, to look at a resurgence of arranged marriages? Because, and the reason I ask is because if that might be the case, then it almost could be, it might be possible to interpret increased bride abduction, which is what you're talking about, as almost more agency for women, if they are, it's obviously mm-hmm. difficult to say if they're
if
consensual
they can,
or not,
if they're
and what is the predominance of consensual kind of elopement versus mm-hmm. non-consensual, but you know, is that interpretation completely off base? Do you know if arranged marriages have increased in the post-Soviet period?
Based on the sample that I had, which was not a scientific sample, it was more of a snowball sample, they were not increasing. There is a very slight increase of arranged marriages post-Soviet, but not as significant as the increase of non-consensual abductions. And most of the arranged marriages aren't what you would think of in terms of an arranged marriage. They're what I call a modern version of arranged marriage, in which the young people meet each other first, and they may even fall in love, and then they go and tell their parents that this is who they want to marry, and the parents do the formality of arranging the marriage. Sometimes the parents are suggesting certain introductions, so there is that level of arranging, but in every case that I heard of arranged marriages, the young people had basically a veto right to say, I'm interested or not interested. And in many cases, they're the ones initiating the marriage, and the parents are just going through the formality. There's a lot of rituals involved with what they call a kudak tusu marriage.
So in other words, bride abduction represents much less freedom of choice than even arranged marriage does in this day.
I wouldn't go that far because there's so much variation in bride abduction. Certainly more so than the non-consensual bride abduction, but I think a lot of the consensual bride abductions can involve a lot of women's freedom. Yeah.
So you were talking about the reasons for bride abduction and listed mm-hmm. some of them, and I mean, essentially, like, my impression is that your presentation boiled down to the fact that bride abduction is kind of a certain manifestation of male violence and domination of female sexuality, which kind of has the same implications of this entire feminist discourse about unveiling Afghan women,
mm-hmm.
which I think has its own dangers. But I mean, in the Russian Caucasus, compared, let's say, to Central Asia, you know, I think one of the major incentives for bride abduction is going to be the honor. Like, and what I mean is that it's kind of cool for a young man or a young jigit to abduct a woman, and it doesn't really have the gender dimension in the front, but it would rather have the kind of the clan dimension. You know, when you expand your clan or your family, kind of without any losses, economic losses primarily, and that makes you kind of a, you know, honorable member of the clan.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I mean, what do you think about this? Like, have you seen that in Central Asia? Have you seen this kind of incentive for young men to abduct women? or you haven't?
It's similar to what Laura Handrahan was talking about, kidnapping being a way for a man to assert his masculinity. So that's kind of where I would say the studies of masculinity would be important. But I think the opposite side of the question is, how do women feel about these kidnappings and hypothesis? And do they feel that they're, are they being abducted against their will, and how do they react to that?
Isn't kidnapping, and I've just heard that in the North Caucasus, kidnapping is actually part of the tradition. I've heard, and I don't know, because I haven't studied it, but that almost all marriages take the form of this kind of ritualized kidnapping, where it's not really what you're talking about, where, you know, unexpected in some cases, but...
No, I think it's pretty much the same. Like
some of them are consensual.
Right, kidnapping is pretty much the same with Central Asia. It can be consensual.
But there's a huge range of practice.
Yeah,
that labels the same
it's,
thing.
You know, beside those reasons that were listed already for marriage, I think one of the major things is, like, you know, to have this young man who would bring a new member into the clan without causing any economic losses to the clan and expanding the clan that way, or the family. And, you know, it's...
But they do talk some, about the economic...
Besides establishing masculinity, I think it has also something to do with honor and, you know, these other cultural concepts of what constitutes honor in society.
But even in the in any bribe abduction in Central Asia, there would be a bribe price paid in the end, as far as you know, right?
Yeah, it may be less, though, than it would have been with an arranged marriage. And whether it's less because the bride was kidnapped versus an arranged marriage, or whether it's less because her family's less wealthy, is one of the many unknown things. I would say it's a little bit of both. Because there tends to be, the economic elite are the ones that tend to still have arranged marriages. It's those who are middle class and poor that are having the kidnapped marriages more often. So the bride wealth would have been less anyway. Yeah.
I absolutely agree. There's a bit of fine line between cultural thing and like breaking the law, because there is this incentive of men who, when it's really cool to abduct the bride, right? And I took narrative from women, like old women, who were sort of abducted. And I know they were making up stories about women being attracted because it's cool. And they're kind of talking between themselves, right? And especially they're coming to a certain age when starting telling stories about how they were young 50, 60 years ago. Well, they talk about their husbands like being real cool, like they're really attractive, really beautiful women. They really just didn't tell anybody anything, and she found herself suddenly like, house, she hadn't seen anybody, was so scared, oh my god, and then this cool guy comes, oh my, and then we received it for 5 days, and then we have been with him for 65 years. I've done it so many times. So it's such a fine line, and it's very hard to distinguish really what happened after just everything cool down, and they're 5 kids, and they're all so, and bringing a bride from different clans is also very important part of not to mention that, because it's not going back to Islamic tradition, there's very definite rule. You have to marry either a woman either down or the same level. But if you want to go a little bit higher, it's a problem. And it involves payment and tradition or whatever. But if you do this abduction, it's real cool. That's like something to learn for years and generations. And it brings the standard to a certain ground of it.
I just wanted to add to your comment that, speaking about the culture, we don't have to narrow it down to Islamic culture. Look at the Russian Pravoslav tradition and the very secular middle of Moscow waiting. It's tradition, so-called abduction of a woman. After a couple of minutes, the guys bring this young lady back, and they receive some present from this just married man. It's a kind of cultural norm, and without any connection to Islam or backward Asian territories.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. We're talking good about it because the same tradition where we're educating people in Moscow, Russia, examining every nationality, and when they just got married, and the guy has to come to the apartment building, 22 and 18th floor, and everybody knows that he's coming, they block all the entrances and ask for what I'll call that. Anyway, money, gift, and the guy usually comes with a bag of perfume or whatever, lipsticks, something, or they make him sing and dance and do silly things before they go to the It's, I mean, they should be spiced to this.
Otherwise, they remain the taste of something
Matched
food.
Yeah, thank you. Not interesting.
Yes.
I'd just like to make a couple of really quick comments and throw something out. So one of the things about, I'm not quite sure how widespread it was in pre-Soviet times among the Kazakh, and one of the things that would be a mechanism kind of, would be the retaliation of the Bakhtar, in one of the earliest Kazakh novellas, the Bakhtar Shaman, that basically this is a woman who marries the person that she wants to or runs off, rather than what her rich old stepfather wants her to marry, and basically they get chased by the raiding party, and the kind of stuff that Ginny Martin would just see more works.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was one social control mechanism for against it. And the other thing is that if somebody were to ask me how ubiquitous is this in Central Asia, I wouldn't know how to answer that. I really don't know to what extent it's in specific places, or hearing about Turkmen, I've never heard about it. With Uzbeks, there are certain issues, but I really don't know to what extent it's ubiquitous. So I think that's one question I would ask. And what I'll throw out is just kind of an idea. I'm glad that Junko mentioned the North Caucasus practice, because for me this has always been, I've heard of it, Kuskachimuk or things like that in various languages, but I think of it classically as something from the North Caucasus more so than from other regions.
Yeah, if you read Lermontov, he describes a classic case of kidnapping, which kind of makes you think that back then it was already practiced.
And, what I'd like to throw out is that it seems to me that you did a kind of good job of talking a little bit about how certain things were restructuring, how certain cultural practices were restructuring and being reinterpreted. And I'm just even wondering, with late Soviet, at the end of the Soviet period, beginning of the Soviet period, there's certain kinds of, existing practices or very, very rare practices, self-immolation of women.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I don't think of that as something ubiquitous or historical in Central Asia, and of course, how much do we really know about it? But, that seems to me to be something that, a moment where, is it that they're just pulling a practice from India or something like that and kind of transplanting it there? In Soviet times, there were certain trans-regional cultural phenomena. If you use the word tamada, everybody in Central Asia will understand it throughout the Soviet Union, but it's a Georgian practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, is it because of, let's say, Chechen refugees, deportees from the North Caucasus in Central Asia, is it just as a phenomenon of Soviet culture that certain ideas, like the notion of honor, that like the notion of kidnapping a bride, that they became transplanted or they became, the borders, the regional borders throughout the Soviet Union became more porous, and because of the shift in the economies, because of the end of the social contract, because of increased poverty, because of other issues, were some things just kind of coming together in a new way, and now it's functioning in a different way than it did before. I'm just throwing that out, and it's something
really
we can talk about over dinner with anybody who wants to join.
They're really interesting ideas. Well, the connections with the Caucasus are something that needs to be explored further. The evidence from pre-Soviet history of Kazakhstan would be before some of these. There was connections with the Caucasus, but they've strengthened during the Soviet period with the deportations, among other things. There was already bride abduction happening. It just wasn't that common. So whether the increase is due to these trans-regional influences, it would be interesting to find out. I don't know how you could ever figure out and make those connections.
It's good to have lots of work to do, right?
But yeah, it would be interesting to explore. Yeah.
I completely agree about this. And I want to mention something else. During the Soviet period, which I think I know something but all those cultural prehistoric differences in every nation were pretty much wiped out. And we will work, like in our generation, we will grow up. We knew about our nationality because it was a landing passport to Costa Rica. Mm-hmm. Besides that, we knew almost nothing. Mm-hmm. Because our parents already, knowing that following Greek Soviet tradition could compromise your employment, mm-hmm. your advanced work, your acceptance to higher level of education, they were actually not discussing this. So our generation, generation after us, we're completely without the knowledge what it really looked like before Revolution 17. So when it came back after 91, I strongly believe they were mostly fairy tale than bringing mm-hmm. back the real tradition, because mm-hmm. there were very few publications, and I've been in this profession quite a while and had training, and it was really a problem to find a good book where you could read about what really happened, what was not what they saw in 20s and 30s and what they were fighting against. Mm-hmm.
Feudal patriarchal prejudice. Customs.
You know, so people are trying to bring back pre-Soviet traditions sometimes. Mm-hmm.
But don't know what they are.
They're making that up. Sometimes they're bringing back ridiculous stuff, which never existed. And they mm-hmm. try to convince people that that's the only way those nations were living before 1917. So they should do real good research trying to separate those. Because sometimes the so-called traditions are ridiculous. They're really kind of...
It's an invention.
They invented the invention tradition.
Or at least they exaggerated
some people think. And same problem is with Russia. Because now, Christmas, 7th of January, it's official holiday. And we go there pretty much every year. And we see our Orthodox Christian relatives trying to celebrate Christmas. And I swear to God, they don't know what they're doing. None of them. They cannot think about anything that is really Christmas. They take something with Santa Claus, you know, when they see on American TV, and they hear the expression. They know totally nothing. You go to the church, and you see a crowd of people standing on Christmas night with absolutely lost expression on their faces. They don't know what they're doing. They hear them because they're supposed to, and then they stand there and say, okay, I'm so bored. I think everything, the same thing happens with other nations. I know Jewish community here in the United States. They come here claiming that they want to bring their Judaic tradition back. And then they're sitting here, absolutely don't know what they're doing and why. So I think it's a very serious problem. 80 years of Soviet secularism did its job. Wow.
Yeah, I would agree. It was related to one of the points I made about the re-narrativization of the past being directly related to the politics of the present. So I would not disagree at all.
Are there any burning last questions?
Two great ones, I guess. One is, would the Lum teach this to the Kazakhs, or would the Kazakhs teach by kidnapping to the Lum? And the second one is, if it's so shameful for the back to her family, what level of shame is there in never having anyone try to kidnap you at all?
Okay, for the first one, I would say that bride kidnapping is not limited to Central Asia and the Caucasus. It's actually been found in a number of cultures worldwide, including in Mexico, among Turks, pretty much in every continent in Africa. It's been found, so I think they're independent.
So it goes way back.
Yeah, it goes way back in lots of different cultures. There's been cross-cultural studies. There's often a link to the stress on virginity before marriage and the shame of a woman returning home. But each practice does vary, and I don't know if there's a relationship between Kazakh and Hmong just because of the physical distance between them. And then the second question, it is shameful if one never gets married. There's a Kazakh expression.
I'm not talking about marriage, but being
never being kidnapped.
No one even attempted.
If they get married in another route, then it's not shameful. Mm-hmm. If they fall in love and get married for a more modern marriage. marriage or have an arranged marriage, it's not shameful. If they don't get married, there's a lot of stigma attached to being an unmarried old girl. Carter goes